I think we're always going to need a poverty line. I think it is really important for people to get the sense of the level of deprivation in such a rich world. I think that maybe we've come towards the end of a dollar consumption measure being the way to do that.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Many of us can recall when we first discovered that there were more than a billion people in the world who lived on a dollar a day. Or, if you're younger than me, $1.25 or $1.90. This extreme poverty line has been effective at raising awareness in the media and creating a focus on the goals of development. But if we want to eradicate poverty rather than describe it, is it a useful tool? And what could improve on it? Charles Kenny of the Centre for Global Development has just written a provocative paper that raises these questions, and he joins me now. Charles, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks very much for having me, Tim.
Charles, this concept of a poverty line, a bread line as it used to be called, has been around since the 19th century, hasn't it? What's the concept, the original idea behind it?
I think if you go back to the 19th century, one of the things that was going on were a bunch of well-meaning liberal types were looking around the Industrial Revolution and going, why is it that this seems to be doing nothing, if anything, worse than nothing for the quality of life of the poorest people in England? And, you know, there's been a raging battle about that in the history of economics since, but I think it still holds up that for at least the sort of first 50 years of the Industrial Revolution, it didn't do very much at all for the quality of life of the poorest people. And indeed, in some terms, like in pollution and so on, it got a lot worse. And so they went out and actually tried to quantify this by asking poorer people in communities, how much do you have to live on? And tried to calculate that in a consistent way. The result was a bunch of studies saying, this is how many people live in this kind of deprivation. And it did have an impact on public policy in the UK in the 19th century.
What we're talking about is the extreme poverty line, which I believe is a creation of the World Bank. When did this come about? Why was it created?
In the 1990s, when it sort of really got its big start with the World Bank World Development Report, it comes out of a not completely dissimilar set of issues. The World Bank at the time was pushing structural adjustment very hard, and there were real concerns that structural adjustment, while arguably necessary for long-term economic growth, was throwing a lot of people into worse poverty. Mm-hmm. And that put the focus on poverty and put the focus on the need for better poverty metrics. In an intellectual advance of not small proportions, the World Bank actually set out to measure how many people in the world live below a particular consumption line. And that was a major undertaking. And as you say, I think it has had a big effect on the global discussion around development and poverty.
It's a big, simple number. I imagine it's deceptively simple. What decisions, what sort of adjustments would a statistician have to make to come up with a number like this poverty line?
We don't have long enough to go through all of the details, but let's just talk about some. I mean, to begin with, you need at least two different survey mechanisms. You need a survey mechanism that is about trying to measure the consumption of people in a particular country at a particular time. And for example, we have a living standards measurement surveys that do that, and they go on for hundreds of pages asking questions like, how much rice did you produce and eat? How much rice did you buy? And then multiply that question by everything else you might produce or buy. And so you collect all of that data, and then you have to collect data on prices. So you go out into the market, and the International Comparisons Project does this, goes out in the market, and it tries to buy, as it might be, 200 grams of fish in a paper wrapper and figure out how much that 200 grams of white fish in a paper wrapper costs, and then puts all of that data together across countries at a particular time. And that gives you a sort of constant set of prices for the same goods, sort of, we hope. And that's just the beginning, because then you've got to start doing things like, do you believe the survey results? Over time, what you do with the fact that the cross-country surveys only happen once every few years, the in-country surveys happen staggered over time across different countries, how do you match them all up? You've got to make decisions about what you do with the data you don't believe. And then you have to come up with a line. You've got to say, this is how I'm setting my poverty line. And yet again, that takes a whole bunch of assumptions. You try and measure a particular set of goods that you're going to hold constant across countries and say, how much would it cost to buy those goods? Do you take existing national poverty lines? Do you take the mean of them, the median of them? Do you update them over time? The decisions go on and on and on and on.
And let's not forget that this line carries a message with it, which has to be that people below the line don't have something that people above the line do have. I know we're going to get into the details of this later, but in general terms, what is that message? What are we saying that people below the line do not have?
So the messaging on that has changed a little bit over time in the World Bank. To begin with, it was about suggesting there was a certain minimum level of consumption that you just needed to live. Mm-hmm. And this was sort of kind of a measure of that. I think now it is advertised as this is what the world's very poorest countries think is a minimum level of decent consumption. Mm-hmm. Look, either way, what it is definitely a measure of is not having enough to consume. That people under this line, people at this line, I'd argue people way over this line, are consuming way too little for a high quality of life. To that extent, it's a great measure in that it measures something that's definitely a problem.
But with all the problems that you've set out there, it has been extraordinarily successful, hasn't it, at getting people who don't live in this world all the time and certainly don't live in the world that the most extremely poor people live in to discuss it and be aware of it. Why has it been so successful?
Because I don't think you can argue that living on $2.15 a day, even if poorly measured, mm-hmm. is way too little for a good quality of life, especially rich people. People who could never even get close to imagining how to live on just $2.15 a day. I think it is a very clear and clever way of making the reality of global poverty somewhat more meaningful to people, as you say, who have got no first-hand sense of it. I've worked in global development for ages. I've traveled a lot. I've worked on surveys in developing countries. I don't really have a proper sense of it. And for me, the number is still quite visceral as a result. I do think in that way, it is an incredibly powerful number.
I was really surprised to find out just how many adjustments to the way that this line has been calculated have been made over the last 3 decades. How radical have these changes been over the years?
So I mentioned all the choices that go into this, the price of the fish in a paper bag across different countries at the same time, and you know, all of this kind of stuff. How do you make all of these choices? One thing that's happened is that the World Bank staff making the choices have changed the choices they've made over time. That has had one impact on the numbers we get. Obviously, the more data, more information, the changing state of the world has also had an impact. Mm-hmm. Sort of separate out those two impacts and look at the impacts that are about the way the world has changed and the way that the calculation has changed. If you just look at the calculation changes, the current poverty line set by the World Bank is at $2.15 a day. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to be kind of an update of the original dollar a day number, allowing for inflation and so on over time. But if you backcast that current $2.15 number as well as we can back to 1990, the number you actually get is somewhere between $1.53 and $1.90, depending if you're using the mean or the median.
Okay.
Now, remember back in 1990, the number they set was a dollar. So what that suggests is over time, the poverty line has become more generous. I want to use scare quotes around the more generous.
Yes, generous is doing a lot of work in that phrase, isn't
in
it?
That it is still a really low amount of consumption, but probably it's more consumption. And there are good reasons to think it is more consumption than was being caught by the original dollar a day line.
There's a choice about where to fix this. So how has the number of people that we consider to be extremely poor, or where those people are, how has that changed as a result of these decisions?
If you use the 1990 dollar a day number, as best we could calculate in our paper, and I admit, you know, we had to make a whole bunch of choices too.
Yeah.
We reckon probably at the 1990 dollar a day number, if you forecast that number and stuck it into the latest data we have, a little under 5% of the world would be in poverty. Now, the official number who are living under the poverty line today, according to the World Bank, is closer than 10%. You know, of course, that matches up, right? The 1990 number was lower, we think, and so fewer people are in poverty today under that number than under the current World Bank number. again, scare quotes.
Yeah.
I think the 10% number is an underestimate of how many people are really living sure. lives of extreme deprivation on many terms. But we'd be closer to meeting our goal of eradicating extreme poverty by 2030, which is one of the sustainable development goals. Indeed, we'd be on track for it if we were still using the 1990 number. We're way off track if you're using the 2022 numbers. So it is a fairly big change. It also, over time, has had a really dramatic change on where those extreme poor are. If you use the earliest numbers compared to the latest numbers, and hundreds of millions of people in East Asia in the meantime moved in and out of poverty. So it really did have fairly dramatic impacts on the regional breakdown of where poor people were, if you will.
Do we have more or less data about the world's poorest people now than we did in 1990?
In most ways, the short answer is a lot more.
Yeah.
We've got more surveys. We've also got a lot better at this cross-country comparison stuff and the number of countries who take part in the surveys. I will say the one thing that pushes against that is if you look at where poor people are today under kind of any measure, they tend to be at the very tail of a distribution in two senses. The tail of a distribution in a bunch of middle-income countries, or many of them are, and a tail of a distribution in terms of cross-country income. So they're in the very poorest countries in the world, unsurprisingly. Both of those things make it harder to measure. Our survey instruments at a given time are best in the middle of the distribution, if you will. Trying to catch the tail end is harder. While we've got more data, we've also got a harder data challenge.
So moving away a little bit from the process of putting this number together, let's talk a little bit about what it represents. As we discussed before, many of us think about this poverty line as a sort of a basic needs idea, what the minimum level of goods and services that people would need. Does it successfully do that? Does it represent a consistent level of consumption?
In the early days, I think there was the claim that it did. It's always been based on the poverty lines of the world's poorest countries. Mm-hmm. Which countries those are has changed dramatically over time, and whether it's the mean and the median has changed and so on. But it was always based on the poverty lines of the world's poorest countries. And the argument at the beginning was, if you look at those countries, their poverty lines are flat over a rising national income, which is to say that the poverty line of a country on $200 GDP per capita was about the same as the poverty line at $500 GDP per capita. When you were in a really poor country, actually poverty wasn't a relative concept like it is in the rich world. Mm-hmm. It really was an absolute concept. We were capturing something absolute about the minimum needed to survive. That's no longer true in the data, that even in the world's poorest countries, as poor countries get a little bit richer, their poverty lines seem to go up a little bit, which is a good thing. Poverty lines should go up as countries get richer. There's not this sense that it's capturing an absolute. And indeed, the current standard is it's the average of all low-income countries. And that will be, as far as I know, the standard going forward. So it's a different set of countries. And the concept behind it is no longer of an absolute basket. It's these sets of countries. And if you use the absolute measure as well as we can, which is you actually go across countries and try and price out a minimum food basket that has the minimum amount of calories and just enough nutritional variety, and you try and add in a few other things like basic housing costs and stuff, you can do that. I will say over time, the numbers track pretty well mm-hmm. on poverty, but it still looks quite different. You get more poverty in Asia, less in the rest of the world. It's not trying to do that. And one alternate approach is to do this absolute consumption basket. Robert Allen and others have suggested that.
If we look away from consumption towards deprivation, which we talk a lot more about these days, does it manage to track a level of deprivation that's consistent across countries?
I guess it depends on your definition of deprivation.
Yes.
That said, we have approaches that try and look at multidimensional poverty and try and look at, you know, do you have access to this? Do you have access to that? Do you have access to clean water? Do you have access to electricity? And the answer is no, not terribly well, either over time or across countries, which is to say, yet again, that people below any given low poverty line tend to see more deprivation than those above. But there's a huge amount of variation between people at the same low income and how much deprivation on these measures they're suffering. To take some good news, the chance that your child dies before the age of 5, if you're a parent, has dropped dramatically over time at the same income. And that's mm-hmm. thanks to more widespread vaccination and so on and so forth. So in that sense, you're getting more bang for your $2.15 than you used to. It is actually largely a good news story that a similar level of consumption income is over time associated with a higher quality of life, but it's still a grim quality of life.
Well, yes, something that no one could deny is that anyone who is at or below that $2.15 level could really benefit from some help. So has this number been useful for policymakers as a way to target their assistance?
That's an interesting question, and one I was a bit surprised doing some very basic analysis of aid flows, for example. So donor countries over time have spent more or less in low-income countries and in LDCs due to various forces, not particularly a lot more than they used to globally in the poorest countries. And if you add a measure of poverty to that, you know, what proportion of this country is at $2.15 a day or less, that does nothing to predict how much aid those countries get. So in that sense, it hasn't had a huge impact. I will say at the country level, national poverty lines, I think, do quite often play a role. As we go forward, possibly it'll play more role both at the national and the international level, partially because it's so much more easy to target than it used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, we do have much better data on who's in poverty and where they are. We can also reach them more easily thanks to mobile finance, which has spread even to some of the world's very poorest people. But I doubt actually even then it'll be the $2.15 line, which is an international line somewhat divorced from national realities, if you will.
So we spent some time today talking about the heroic efforts of trying to establish this line, but also, inevitably, the criticisms that it will always be open to. Does that really matter? Because it's been so effective as a big picture indicator, something that's made people aware of what the problem is. And if policymakers can act on more useful indicators to them, which are maybe more local, more targeted to particular interventions that just don't make newspaper headlines, is that a problem?
I think that's a fair point, and it has been very successful in terms of sort of advocacy, if you will. My worry is twofold. One, that it's too successful, and one is that we'll never be able to declare success.
Right.
Lots of us talk, I mean, I've done it too, about eradicating poverty. And what we mean is eradicating $2.15 poverty, as if somebody on $2.16 is living a life that is as satisfying as ours can be on however many hundredfold that. And it's a terrible line from that point of view. It is not a success line. It is a failure line. It is, how can a world as rich as ours have people living on below $2.15 a day? And yet somehow, sometimes at least, we turn it into this line of success. My second worry is somewhat more parochial, I admit. It's that actually we'll never be able to declare success on the $2.15 a day line because of the way it's calculated. It is calculated as the average of the low-income country poverty lines. We will get rid of low-income countries before we get rid of people living under $2.15 a day. You know, the last low-income country will graduate into middle-income country status. There will still be people living on less than $2.15 a day or whatever the number is at the time, but we'll have no data about them. No way of calculating. So we will not end poverty at $2.15 a day. Poverty, as currently calculated, will no longer be calculated. So we have to fix the line.
Yeah.
In some ways, we have to fix the line for both reasons of declaring an end to absolute failure and for the reason of calculation. We have to do it for declaring the end of absolute failure because if you look at the people who agreed the Sustainable Development Goals in the UN, they thought they were signing up to a fixed line. They weren't. And you can't have a target on eradicating extreme poverty if you don't even know what the extreme poverty line is going to be. And we have to fix the line because otherwise the line will go away before the problem does.
Let's talk about the narrow question first. How would you make this calculation more consistent across time?
I would fix the poverty lines. So rather than updating according to the latest poverty lines at the national level, I would say, look, we're going to take the mean or the median, whichever we'd rather, of these countries' poverty lines at this time and then update. I think that probably is worth doing. I worry that maybe we really ought to be moving to a deprivation measure, mm-hmm. because I think that probably has more life in it in the long term.
Yes, tell me about that. How do you make a deprivation measure?
The sad thing about the Sustainable Development Goals is we're going to miss them all.
Yes.
The joy of the Sustainable Development Goals is they have a whole load of zero targets, which we're going to miss for 2030. But still, the global community has basically said nobody should be without access to electricity. No kid should be out of school through secondary. Everybody should have this. The world agreed them. Every country signed up. I think it's a fantastic basis for a deprivation measure. You go through the Sustainable Development Goals, you say, the world has agreed that everybody should have access to this. That is a deprivation measure we put into our indicator. And the world is not free of poverty until there is not a single person having a deprivation on one of these grounds. It'll give a lot more life expectancy to the measure. Mm-hmm. We will still be worrying about it in 2070, I fear. But perhaps more to the point, it is an agreed and immovable set of deprivation. So we'd be measuring the same thing over time going forward, and it has universal assent. And in that sense, it kind of has more legitimacy than something made up by a bunch of very well-meaning people in the World Bank who've garnered a huge amount of support. After all, the first SDG is extreme poverty as defined by this group of people in the World Bank. Mm-hmm. But still, it has sort of more legitimacy as a measure, I think.
Can I ask you a little bit about how you would make that deprivation measure? Are you adding together different indicators of deprivation, or yes. are you saying if you have like four of these 10?
My preferred answer is just to say you're deprived if you're deprived of any of them. We don't stop trying until we've got rid of all the deprivation because of my fear of declaration of success way too early. You can choose to work out the depth of poverty if you want to. You can say this person is deprived on 60% of the measures we have. And that might be useful, although I'm not really sure it is. I think rather it would be, if you look at electricity access in this country, we've said it should be 100% and it's only 40%. And then that gives some steer to the people working in your energy development department. That it's more at that point, it breaks down to decisions by different parts of government and different parts of the global community.
These measures of deprivation, if they were to be widely adopted, do you think that would give some more meaning to these Sustainable Development Goal targets that often confuse people just because there's so many of them?
I do think there's a problem with the SDGs that they are way too complicated, and this might help with them. We're going to have a decision to make in a couple of years now about what we do in 2030 when we fail to meet nearly all of the SDGs. We had that problem in 2015 and seemed to handle it remarkably well, in that we missed all but one of the Millennium Development Goals and yet nonetheless declared success of the model and created the SDGs, which I think in many ways are a great thing. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll manage to pull off the same trick again. And if one of the things that comes out is a sort of globally agreed deprivation measure, all to the better.
Charles, do you think we're always going to need an extreme poverty line?
I think we're always going to need a poverty line. I think it is really important for people to get the sense of the level of deprivation in such a rich world. I think that maybe we've come towards the end of a dollar consumption measure being the way to do that. Having a measure of deprivation that is reasonably clear for people worldwide to understand what some of their fellow human beings are living in, I don't think we're going to see an end to the need for that anytime soon.
Charles Kenny, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you want to read the paper, it is called An End to Extreme Poverty, or at least the Extreme Poverty Line. And you've just been hearing from the author, Charles Kenny. It is the CGD Working Paper 694. This has been a Vox Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And on that podcast platform, if you want to rate us and leave a review, please do.